Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. Our next speaker is Tom Dreschel, and he's going to be talking to us about peat and carbon loss in the Everglades with historical data and geospatial techniques.
I'll give you the 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for allowing me to present some information on three little projects that we put together. It was kind of a serendipitous time where we were actually doing research on the historic Everglades and trying to gather as much information as we could to put a book together. And so a lot of the information we were able to use to create surfaces in GIS and estimate the amount of peat that was lost in the Everglades in different regions. These are my co-authors, Simonjit H., who was a very sharp young geographer that we had for a short period of time that did a lot of the GIS work on this. Chris McVoy, who did a lot of the background research to find the historic data. And Fabiola, who did a lot of the data mining for us once we were able to locate this data. And so we had these three little projects that we did. One was to evaluate the amount of peat that was lost from the entire Everglades system since the late 1800s when we started messing around with digging canals and farming parts of the Everglades. The second project was focused just on the Everglades agricultural area to see if we could get a better feel for how much soil had been lost from the EAA since the late 1800s. And then it just so happened that we had a survey that was done on a tree island in Water Conservation Area 2 back in the 70s, and we did another survey in 2009, so we were able to create surfaces from the 1973 and 2009 and compare how much peat had been lost from this tree island over that period of time. So the surfaces that we used to compare the pre-drainage Everglades with the current Everglades were on the left, this surface was created for the natural systems regional simulation model that the district uses to predict water flows through the Everglades before the Everglades were basically dramatically impacted by us. And then for the current surface of the Everglades, we used data that was collected for the South Florida Topography Project. And it was a number of different sources of the data, some LIDAR data, some other surface mapping that was done, and it was all kind of stitched together to create a map of the surface of South Florida. And so those were the two surfaces that we used, and we put them in GIS, and we were able to basically calculate how much peat had disappeared from the Everglades between the late 1800s and the current system, and depending on where you look in the region, here's the two surfaces that we created. We lost from 3 to 5 feet of elevation, peat elevation across the Everglades, depending on where you're looking. In the northern Everglades, where there was a lot of peat, we lost a lot of peat. In the southern Everglades, where there wasn't a lot of peat originally, we didn't lose obviously that much. So this is actually published in the Florida Scientist a couple of years ago. So this is what we came up with that had been lost from the Everglades from the late 1800s to the current system by taking the peat and then multiplying it by the bulk densities, an average bulk density for peat soils, and the carbon. Average carbon content of peat soils, we were able to come up with some of these numbers. And so for the EAA, we came up with a CO2 loss of about 2.3 billion metric tons for areas 1, 2A, and 3B, about a tenth of a billion metric tons of CO2. For area 3A, 6 tenths of a billion metric tons, and for 2B and the park, a lot less, 50 to 60 million metric tons. Okay, so then we thought, well, this is kind of a neat way to do things, but can we somehow verify what we're doing? Can we look at two different ways of doing this and get similar numbers? Okay, so we use the Everglades agricultural area as an example, and we used two different methods to estimate soil loss in the Everglades agricultural area. We used historical surveys of the Everglades that were done in the late 1800s and early 1900s, where they actually took a probe. The surveyors went out and took a probe and probed through the peat, and they measured how deep the peat was. And so we had a bunch of this information from these. And if you know about the Labens, which is online, that's where all this data comes from. Early surveys of the Everglades. And that's what this first map is. Now, George Schneider did some surveys back in 2003, and we used his data for those peat thicknesses. So we were able to compare the two different peat thicknesses. Now, for the other method we used, we had a Parker in 1955, and his colleagues published a bedrock map of the Everglades back in 1955. And we used that in the peat surface for the Everglades from the NSRSM model that I showed you earlier. And also, we had the peat surface from the South Florida topography model, which was just clipped out for the Everglades agricultural area. So this was one method for calculating the thickness and the loss, and this was the other method that we used for calculating the thickness and the loss. And we came up with this kind of a model of the soil column. So this is the pre-drainage soil column for the EAA, which was 2.3 meters thick, which the current one ended up being a two-layer system where we used a tilled surface of the soil, which had a little bit higher bulk density but a little bit lower carbon content because it had been impacted by the tillage. And then the lower part of that column we assumed was very similar to the pre-drainage soils. And we did a similar activity for the other methodology. And the numbers came out very, very close to each other when you did a difference between them. So about 2.5 times 78 metric tons of peat were lost, and a release of about 5 times 10 to the 8th metric tons of CO2 from those calculations. So this is the amount of carbon similar to 1 times 10 to the 10th American homes. If you look at it as a per year, if we divide it by 100 years, which was our period of record that we looked at, that's approximately how much carbon is produced by those many homes in a year. So that's a lot of carbon being lost from the Everglades over 100 years. So then the third activity was the use of this historical survey of what we call Dineen Island. Walt Dineen was a researcher in the Everglades back in the days when the tree islands were first starting to be degraded. And this was one tree island he kind of felt like he could see it changing over the little short period of time that he was doing research there. So he asked that they do a survey of the tree island before it got really severely degraded. And so in 1973, they did a regular land survey of this tree island. And then we had another group go out in 2009 and do a similar survey. And these are a few other co-authors for this study, Sharon Yu with Ecology and Environment, and Ben Gu is one of our colleagues at the South Florida Water Management District, were involved in this as well. So here's Area 2, and there's Dineen Island. It's one of what we call a ghost tree island in Area 2. Most of the tree islands in Area 2, if you're not familiar with it, have degraded to the point where there's just a very small head, and there's almost no trees on it. It's all a big sawgrass ridge now. You can see from these photographs This is a 1973 photograph. Let me see if I can use the... This is the one on the left is from 1973, and you can still see trees on the tree island from that aerial photo. The 2003 photo shows it just as a large sawgrass expanse. It's like a large sawgrass ridge. And down below is a photograph that was taken in 2009 from a helicopter. So the little circular area is what's the remnant head, which is on a kind of an limestone outcropping from the bedrock. And so this is actually the survey that was conducted in 1973. The numbers are superimposed on those rows that you see there. And then we, in 2009, these transects were run as well. And so we have profiles from both 1973 and 2009, which correspond to each other. And so then Suminjit created these surface contour maps in GIS by doing kriging and created these, and then did a subtraction between the surfaces to calculate the amount of peat that was lost. We also, from 2009, had soil cores taken, and we had the soils analyses from those. So we were able to actually do some chemistry calculations as well. So we looked at bulk density with depth to see how the soil cores, the bulk density at each level in the soil cores. And as you can see, the bulk density increases with depth. So it becomes more dense, which we would expect because of compression, but also the fact that as a tree island, it was probably had a lot higher density peat as well. So it kind of tells you that it still has a little bit of characteristics of the tree islands. And for those of you who are familiar with tree islands in the Everglades, the head of the tree island typically has phosphorus soil levels that are orders of magnitude higher than the marsh or other parts of the tree island. And one of the things we were interested in looking at was to see if the phosphorus in the ghost tree island heads was also still fairly high. And as you can see from that top graph on the right, the middle bar is from the middle of the tree island head, and it's 33,000 milligrams per kilogram, which is probably, that's a lot, that's 33 grams per kilogram phosphorus, which is typical of what you would see in a normal tree island. Farther down the tail, you get in the 400s and 500s, which you would expect in a normal tree island as well. So it's still showing some of the characteristics of a tree island, even though it's hugely degraded. So the average peat subsidence in the 36 years was about 0.14 meters, which is approximately equivalent to 0.4 centimeters per year. And it's funny because the number we got in that first project for Area 2, where this tree island resides, was 0.42 centimeters per year. So it seems like it's fairly reasonable numbers that we're getting from this. So, and so this tree island lost about 8,000 metric tons of peat in those 36 years, about 3,500 metric tons of carbon, 2.5 metric tons of phosphorus, and 234 metric tons of nitrogen over the 36-year period. So in summary, to kind of talk a little bit about these projects, we feel that the use of these, of GIS and these data sources, which basically give us kind of a peek into the past, give us some insight into what's been happening in the Everglades over the last 100 years. And so we feel like some of the numbers that we can calculate from these differences that we're estimating can give us some insight into how much carbon, how much peat, and even some of the other minerals have been lost over the course of the last century out in the Everglades. And you've seen these pictures all the time. So that's really all I have. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to field them. Any questions? Yeah.
Now, the peat that was lost had the same kind of bulk density relationships as you see on the tree islands, or is it a little bit different from the everglades peat? Increasing depth, increasing bulk density.
Yeah, and typically in a ridge, I would expect that you'd get slight increases in bulk density, but not as severe as you would in a tree island because of the greater amount of mass that's basically compacting the peat. So, it was kind of really I thought was kind of neat that we were able to get access to this data that you can't recreate, and we were able to put it into this GIS system and create these maps. Yes? I don't, but I know George Snyder had a bunch of them, so, yeah. Yeah. Well, if you look, I don't know if I have any of those pictures in here. There's some pictures from Dr. Schneider's report, which actually shows bare bedrock in the southern end of the EAA back in 2003, so I'm sure it's much worse than that now. And so There had been predictions, I'm sure you know, that in 2000 there wouldn't be only half of the area would be farmable, but I think sugarcane has a lot less of an impact, and they've taken a lot of from Dr. Snyder's work. They've taken steps, I think, to try and keep the soils wetter so that they don't. Now, the reason the soils are being lost is because they get dried out. The bacteria have plenty of oxygen to chew on those carbon, and they put it into the atmosphere. It's almost like you're burning it, but it's bacteria that are doing the same thing. Now, with the Everglades themselves, we know that there were a lot of fires in the early Everglades as well. So a lot of the peat loss in the early days of the Everglades after the drainage was due to peat fires, I would think. I think it's a pretty good bet that was the case from that. So, all right, thank you.